Colin Thuburon didn't take a camera on the 7,000-mile journey he made from western China to Turkey along the ancient trade route known as the Silk Road. But readers probably won't miss the photos because Mr. Thuburon has written a book filled with word pictures, detailed observations about the people he met and places he saw. His book, Shadow of the Silk Road, is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings Colin Thuburon back to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Why didn't you take a camera?
One of the reasons is practical, that in these rather dangerous or difficult parts of the world, if you get overhauled by the police, which you do from time to time, they think he hasn't got a camera, he can't be a spy. The other reason is that, as you indicate, often you want the reader to be involved in your own vision of a place. And a camera, of course, returns them to their own eyes, if you like, but you paint a picture really for them.
Well, were you keeping detailed notes, or do you just have a very good memory for detail?
No, I have to keep terribly detailed notes. You imagine that you're going to be, you'll understand or remember what happened a few months at the beginning of a journey, but by the end of it, of course, you can only remember very vague things. And so often the descriptions you give take their life from detail.
This is your sixth travel book, but you've also written four novels, one of which, To the Last City, made the long list for the Booker Prize. How much of an overlap is there between your travel writing and your fiction?
Usually rather little. It seems that the novels are reactions against the travel books and vice versa. The travel books are about a fascination with the outside world. But my novels are often rather introverted. One set in a prison, another set in a mental hospital. They're places where people can't travel at all. I can't account for this.
And there's no dialogue between the two?
Very little. There's been some in one or two travel books have been set abroad. But mostly, one or two of the novels have been set abroad, but mostly they've been these rather personal and enclosed places. They seem to come from two different parts of my own psyche, if you like. The travels are about fascination with often distant and little-known places, and the novels are the opposite. They're very personal and internal.
But in this case, you have created a fictional character for a work of nonfiction.
Yes, it happened without my really planning it. I suddenly found that in the midst of writing what was a very sort of objective, if you like, travel journal, trying to write as exactly as I could, as accurately as I could about a journey that I'd already undertaken, it was suddenly intruded on by this fictional character who was an ancient trader along the Silk Road. And I thought, well, this is rather ridiculous, this little bit of fiction. I'll probably lose it. It'll be too pretentious. But I find I kept it. Of course, he speaks to me, and it's two parts of myself, I guess, talking to one another. He's a rather cynical, hard-headed part of myself, and the other part that he's talking to is a more romantic, woolly part. And it simply became a dialogue in a few parts of the book that in the end I kept.
He's a Sogdian merchant.
He's a merchant, yeah.
What is a Sogdian?
A Sogdian, these people once controlled much of the Silk Road. They were people who have vanished now, but who lived in Central Asia, centered on Samarkand. And I took him as a prototype of a hard-headed trader and what he would have thought of my modern journey, and made a little play of that.
Well, it almost reminds me of the sort of thing that a Diderot might have done, in which he created a master and a servant, and their conversations somehow add up to a discussion about the existential dimensions of an experience.
Yes, it was a little bit like a Don Quixote, if you like, a Don Quixote and a Sancho Panza. There's the sort of practical, cynical one, and the one who's more idealistic. And I didn't, you know, I wrote them a little like poetry. They just came. They were very unreally planned. And I was sure I was going to just scrap them at the end of writing this book, but I didn't. I thought they did add something.
Well, you do have a lot of conversations with real people that you met along the journey. How would it have been more difficult if you hadn't been able to speak in Mandarin and Russian?
It would have been almost impossible. Particularly the sheer mechanics of traveling alone in often quite wild parts of northwest China, say, or Central Asia, you couldn't do it without the language, really. It would be incredibly hard. And in my case, and I've struggled to learn these languages, at least to be able to speak, if not to read and write well, but in order to communicate with ordinary people.
So they must have been surprised that you spoke the languages as fluently as you do.
Yes, they were surprised. The Chinese in particular have an idea that their language is too complicated and difficult for foreigners to understand. So they would look at each other in bewilderment and express disbelief that you had spoken Mandarin.
I had that experience when I lived in Chinatown for quite a few years, and I picked up some Chinese, some Cantonese, and I would say something to a shopkeeper, and they'd look at me like, oh my God, the monkey can talk.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Of course, in these parts of China, particularly northwest China, this great province of Xinjiang, which is a desert province, a lot of the people speak a very difficult dialect, and I had a lot of trouble understanding.
But Mandarin is the language that everybody speaks.
Mandarin's the lingua franca for the common language for the north, the whole of the north of China, the whole of the span that I was taking from east to west. It's the south that speaks Cantonese.
Well, how did you wind up learning these languages? You didn't do it in preparation for writing this book.
No, I had learnt or attempted to learn Mandarin before for an earlier book on China some 20 years ago. And I simply employed, I was able to, luckily, a private tutor in Mandarin so that I could learn to speak, but not really to write. It's so hard to write the language because you have to remember what those characters are, what they signify, and how you pronounce them. There's another system by which the language is turned into our alphabet, and you can learn it to speak from that, but not, of course, to write.
My guest is Colin Thubron. His latest book, Shadow of the Silk Road, published by HarperCollins. And I'm assuming this book grows out of other travel books that you have written, where you went to Russia and China. But is the Silk Road still a place that people take very seriously? For example, you could write about Route 66 in the United States. But the only people who travel Route 66 these days, I think, are people who want to write about Route 66.
Right. Silk Road is almost a sort of mythic road. The term Silk Road is a 19th century coining by a German geographer. Nobody spoke of the Silk Road in the 2,000 years of its life before then. And so it's almost like a sort of concept or legend. And it varied all the time. In earlier periods, depending on the movement of brigands, the decay of empires, or even sometimes some ecological change, the route change with it. And so you can travel almost anywhere from east to west, west east across the breadth of Asia, a quarter of the length of the equator, and you'll probably still be on the Silk Road.
And it could just as easily have been called the Paper Road, the Gunpowder Road, the Tea Road.
Yes, it could. It wasn't just silk that traveled it. It was really everything on the known earth traveled this road at some stage or another, whether it was frankincense or rhinoceros horn or ostriches or even a caged lion or two went at some stage or another.
But as you have suggested, even though you traveled the entire length of this Silk Road or this fretwork of roads, no one in its heyday probably went from the beginning to the end.
No, virtually nobody. The goods were passed from hand to hand in a sort of relay race till they might reach their destination. A couple of years later, vastly increased in price, but also increased in mystique. Nobody would then know who had manufactured them or even perhaps what they were made of in some cases. There was a great mystique about silk, for instance. The Romans had no idea where silk came from.
Now, you travel through this area when an awful lot of things were happening. SARS epidemic had broken out. You were going into Iran at a time when there was quite a bit of tension. Is this a problem for someone like you? After all, you must have stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, I knew some of it was dangerous. North Afghanistan was the most dangerous part, which I traveled to in 2004. These are calculated risks, and I find that when I'm traveling in order to write a book, as in this case, I'm taking risks that I'd never normally take if I was on vacation or even just traveling for interest. You do it for the sake of the book, really.
Well, you did discover some interesting things. For example, people you met in the former Soviet republics, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, had fond memories of life under Joseph Stalin. And one woman you met still revered Lenin, despite the fact that he was responsible for the deaths of her husband and her father.
Yes, this is a phenomenon we can never quite understand in the West, I think, that the effect of those a leader like Stalin in those years and among those people was of such potency that they still go on believing in his near divinity in spite of everything that's been revealed about him. And, of course, the Soviet Union to these poorer republics like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, that fell off the bottom of the Soviet Union, if you like, in 1991 when it broke up, they received a lot of their benefits from the Soviet Union, their educational system, their health system, and so on. And they tend now, in a poorer time, to look back with nostalgia at that period.
You've said that many of the borders between the nations seemed false or artificial. So when you met people like the Uyghurs, for example, or the Tibetan Buddhists that you met in China, did they think of themselves as, did they identify themselves with their country or their area or with their religion?
With their people and their religion, with their regional people. The Uyghur, who are this big Muslim group within China, you know, you're 1,000 miles within China, and the people are not Chinese mainly, they are these Uyghur Muslim people. They identify with their own Turkic Uyghur people as a separate nation. And, of
and
course,
China is very upset about Muslim. That.
Yes, as Muslims.
One of the interesting things, thinking about how much Stalin is still admired in some parts of the former Soviet Union, you visited the Ayatollah Khomeini's tomb, and hardly anybody was there.
Yes, yes, this enormous tomb. It's a whacking great Muslim shrine. You can see it for miles over the plains south of Tehran. And you go in, and it's sort of rather sad and empty. There are a few sort of soldiers sitting there. And it was a place, basically, that was a huge architectural complex built to house people who have lost interest.
Although just not far away, there were lots of visitors to a cemetery.
Yes, this was a sadder place, only less than a mile away, I suppose, called the Behesht-e Zahra, which was where a good 200,000 young soldiers are buried who were killed in the Iran-Iraq war.
You have written that you were always conscious during your journey that a book needed to come out of your experiences. Is a travel writer's greatest fear that nothing might actually happen?
Yes, I think so. You don't mind whether something good or bad happens. The fear is that nothing's going to happen at all. There's almost as if there are two of you going, you know, there's the one who's traveling, and on his shoulder is sitting this one who's going to write about it.
And so you say, oh, gee, I haven't had anything interesting happen to me in days. I'm in trouble.
Yes, just as the one who's traveling is being shot and mugged and so on, the one on his shoulder saying, good, this is good copy, we can use this.
Well, that has to make the experience odd. I was going to have you read. Unfortunately, we don't have much more time, but I wonder about the Silk Road, because there are other people who have also written about the Silk Road in recent years. Does everybody find something different there?
Oh, yes. It's such a complex route. It's so multifaceted. As far as I know, nobody in our modern day has written of a journey from one end to the other.
Now, Rob Gifford, he whose NPR's Beijing chief, went 3,000 miles across it, but you did 7,000.
7,000 is literally from Xi'an, the old capital, where the Terracotta Warriors are, right to Antioch on the coast of Turkey, which is where the Silk Road in most periods ended. And so, yes, I wanted to do the whole thing. It's only become possible recently.
Are you off to another adventure, or are you working, confining yourself to a small space in a novel?
I'm thinking of a novel again, probably a small space.
And would it have to be a small space?
It wouldn't have to be.
I mean, couldn't you have written a novel about somebody going on the old Silk Road?
I could, but I think I would never dare, I think, to put myself in the shoes of, say, an ancient trader or even a modern Chinese. I think it would be pretty inappropriate for me to do that. So I guess the novel will be set back in the West.
I mentioned that you were in China during the outbreak of the SARS epidemic. Were the Chinese officials worried that you might help spread it, or were you worried for your health?
I wasn't worried. They were worried. And there was an enormous campaign, one of these great campaigns of which communist China is capable, to suppress it. And I was interned on the edge of the Taklamakan Desert, which was one of the worst deserts on Earth, for the SARS epidemic. And then I think they got rather scared that my death statistic was going to be on their records, and they pushed me on in the next bus westward. But I was never scared that it was going to hit me, really. It was a long way to the east.
Colin Thurbrunn will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Asia Society. That's at 725 Park Avenue at 70th Street. His book, Shadow of the Silk Road, is published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us.